Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 178, featuring Andre Matos, who is a really interesting guy. I've, you know, seen his work and sort of chatted with him online forever, but finally got to catch up with him in person at Total Chaos, which was obviously in Sofia, happened several weeks back, but it was really great to talk to him. He's a really interesting guy. He grew up in the small islands off the coast of Portugal, about 1,000 miles off the coast of Portugal, called the Azores, and started doing 3D there, and then became an expert. Fell into this amazing job that he's doing as an expert in car rendering for Porsche, and does a lot of their great renderings over there for some of the big trade shows over at their auto shows. And what's also cool about it is that he was one of the people that sort of embraced GPU rendering for extremely large-scale stuff, as well as VR scans, which is our VRDF scanner that we have. And it was really cool to see all the amazing work he can do with that. Really nice guy, very resourceful and very imaginative. And we end up having some long conversations about the tricks, tips and tricks about rendering cars, which is actually quite an art to it. I know it is, because I used to do a lot of car commercials in my day. He really sort of shares some of those passions and things that we knew about. And hopefully you guys can learn from it as well. In terms of announcements, we don't have, we do have a big announcement. V-Ray Next for Maya Beta is out. It's in public beta. So if you guys are Maya users and want to know what's new in V-Ray Next and want to try out some of these amazing features, including the adaptive dome light and faster GPU rendering and all kinds of new stuff, the new hair shader, go ahead and download V-Ray Next beta for Maya. And give it a try. Let us know what you think. That's obviously what betas are there for you guys to kick the tires on it. Tell us what's going on. Tell us if things are working or not working. And we'd love to hear more about that. So that's very exciting. In other news, let's see. There's the... yes, that's right. I mentioned it, I think, last time. But Jeff Model and CG Architect, and as well as us and NVIDIA and HP, there's a project called the... HP Mars Home Planet, and I think it's just called hpmarshomeplanet.com, and it's a competition for rendering some amazing stuff in terms of visualizing Mars as a place to live in. That's an architecture project on Mars. I think it's really kind of cool, so go ahead and check that out and enter the competition. There's some amazing prizes, some really great stuff that's being given out, so go ahead and do that. It'd be really cool to do that. Let's see what else is going on. SIGGRAPH is happening. As you guys know, it's in mid-August in Vancouver, and we are gung-ho planning for that. We will be doing our V-Ray days there. There's several talks that are being solidified now, so we'll announce the schedule soon, but some really great speakers coming up. I'm already very excited about that. And there's also some amazing stuff that we'll be showing there. I know we're being very ambitious about it, but I'm sure there'll be some really good announcements happening at SIGGRAPH this year again. So that is very, very exciting. And I think that's about all I have for now on that. And hopefully you guys will enjoy this really cool podcast I did with Andre Matos, who is a really, really kind guy and a very artistic guy and a very ambitious guy. So it was really great to hang out with him. All right. Enjoy, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
How have you been?
It's already recording?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. It's so easy. It was just one click. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Andre. So let's talk about this stuff that you've been doing. This is crazy. Well, the couple things is, one thing is you decided to just go with GPU rendering, right? that's made a big difference, right?
I think what forced me really to jump into the GPU situation was lack of money.
Lack of money?
No, seriously. When I 4 years ago, I moved out into Germany.
Uh-huh.
And you're just a strange guy, you know, and I didn't have that much money on that time to invest in hardware solutions to output what I wanted to do when I moved out from my place.
Uh-huh.
And GPU was amazing already on that time, and people were running away from GPU because of certain limitations, like guys from the industry.
Uh-huh.
Guys with budgets for render farms,
right?
That they didn't really had to play with render times or money, and I was just a rookie between mm-hmm. them, and I thought, like, I have to find a way to do my own stuff,
right?
So I started learning GPU rendering, playing with the limitations back on that time. There was like almost no limitations already,
mm-hmm.
and right now it's completely production ready,
right?
And one thing took to the other one,
right?
And then it was that's how. That was a super fast transition from doing nothing to start outputting almost everything for them.
Well, but it, okay. So, but what inspired this? I mean, what got you into 3D, and why do you do this kind of stuff?
Well, if you ask me if the automotive industry is my passion, it's not. It's I do like cars, but my passion is definitely the short film production.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's the storytelling. It's the possibility to just visualize something that you imagine,
mm-hmm.
and that's the artistic part of it.
It's not did really you go and did you go to school to learn that or?
No, I will tell everybody, Professor Google. You
know, yeah, Professor Google.
If you shape yourself the way you want to shape, you will always follow the direction you want to follow.
It's possible, absolutely, to learn that way. And you just when did you start learning this stuff?
Well, I was. First of all, I came from a small place. It's called Azores. It's a group of nine small islands in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
Uh-huh.
And I was doing a lot of small things, such as design, like product design, like packaging.
Yeah.
Web design. It's a small market. I mean, you have to pay the bills.
Right.
But I was always doing side projects in 3D, but small things when I had extra time to do
right.
that. And so and when I jumped to Germany, I jumped thirsty for progress or to make something different, not
uh-huh.
like again, print web design was not really what I wanted to do.
Sure.
So I started doing my personal projects mm-hmm. at the beginning, like short films,
mm-hmm.
side by side, working as a motion designer for doing content for Porsche,
uh-huh.
as a motion designer, After Effects
like
guy.
Like an After Effects guy, okay.
Yeah, and on my
and were they making time, films and stuff like that? Or?
They were, because we are doing below-the-line communication for the car exhibitions that they are doing, and uh-huh. you need to really produce all the content according to the pixel mapping you have.
Right.
Because every exhibition, they change the shape of the LED. They always like to have this exclusive graphics. They like, you know.
For
like,
everything.
Yeah,
okay.
yeah. Personalized great. Content.
So that's how you started working with Porsche, right?
Exactly.
Well, and this is in Stuttgart?
In Frankfurt.
In Frankfurt,
also
okay.
in Frankfurt. IAA, the big car exhibition is happening there.
Uh-huh,
so strategically
uh-huh.
makes more sense to have local people working there since they plan like, since they start working 8 months before.
Right, of course.
So it's like more than half of the year already working on the next car exhibition.
Yes, so. Yeah, I'm sure. Wow. Okay. And so how did you get connected with Porsche? What how did that happen?
It was
by luck, or they said they needed someone and saying I'm available, or
no, I have a friend
mm-hmm.
In Azores. And every time that he was flying there, I'm going to repeat myself. I have a friend in Azores that is working in Germany for more than 25 years.
Ah, okay.
You know? And every time that he was flying there, he was working in an automotive industry, and he was always like teasing me, saying, hey man, what are you doing here? I mean, you have skills, just try to go to Germany and then I will try to get something for you.
Yeah, good.
And this guy was working for more than 8 years as a art director for Mercedes. So
okay.
he already had a few contacts, but mm-hmm. I had a flight.
Mm-hmm.
So I grabbed an airplane. I went to Germany, mm-hmm. Frankfurt, and like in less than 2 hours, I got a job from
really?
Him. Yeah. So he kind of introduced me to one of his ex-co-workers that mm-hmm. was actually doing already content for Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the boy from the island, you know, like just step in. He's going to start doing small stuff in After Effects to see if he can start outputting more. And it was like, it was super, super, super.
Yeah.
Progressive because the German market it's quite nice if you want to work. I mean, if you want to work, you will work
definitely. That's good.
Things happen over there.
Yeah, there's plenty of demand. I guess. Right.
If you output, you will output.
And it's amazing how those things can happen. Like my wife sort of got a similar situation where she didn't have a job and she had a friend of ours and it was our neighbor who says, you know, I'm doing job and our. There's some graphic or motion graphic stuff that my company is looking for. You should come over and apply. And so she applied as like an intern or a PA. And they say, yeah, no, you've got too much knowledge of this. We actually have we'll hire you as a freelancer on this project real quick for the Olympics at the time. We were doing some graphics for the Olympics. Mm-hmm. And so she started doing that and then quickly like, and then just kept going and going and going, right?
Yeah.
And learning more and
they
more.
They squeeze the juice. I mean, yeah. There's juice over there. Why don't you squeeze it?
Yeah, exactly.
That's what happened there. Like back in Azores, I mean, they cannot squeeze. There's nothing to do.
Right. Yeah.
You're doing package design for tea, for tobacco. You're not even doing big campaigns. Maximum, you do like a 360 campaign for a package of sausages because mm-hmm. they produce meat over there. So mm-hmm. you can imagine the contrast between the environment that I was living in when
right.
I jumped to Frankfurt. It was easy to just have motivation to keep going and keep going and keep going, conquering more and conquering more.
Right,
and,
right, right.
And
yeah, well, that's cool. So then I guess you've been doing 3D on the side the whole time and you decided, let's see if I can push more and more 3D. Or?
Every time, mm-hmm. every single day. Actually, right now I don't even open After Effects anymore.
Really?
No, I mean, rather be a master in one art than a fool in all parts, you mm-hmm. know? I mean, if you know a lot of things, you will always be the guy that does small things in everything.
And right.
I decided to focus only in 3D.
And
by now,
but and you're always kind of a freelancer in this situation, right? Is that what?
No, I have a contract.
You have a contract.
Like four years producing content already.
Okay, but then what sort of inspired you? Is like, you know, I got to get a computer, and I got to make it render fast. So how did that happen?
I have to be honest. If I will have a crystal ball and check the future in the next 4 years, mm-hmm. for me, I would say, okay, it's broken. Just send it back. Mm-hmm. This is not what it's going to happen. I start working in GPU rendering because I always had this passion for short film production. Mm-hmm. And
you thought you were going to make content in 3D with it?
Or? Yeah, I wanted to get the skills, mm-hmm. mainly to tell stories and keep going. And I realized that with that, I could actually produce content for big pixel mappings, insane big pixel mapping, sorry.
And what is pixel mapping for
pixel
people?
Mapping is it's the resolution of the main LED that you have in the car exhibitions, like okay. these big screens behind the cars.
Mm-hmm.
Normally they have like 15K.
Oh, wide yeah, they're pixel really mappings, huge.
And they really want to make sure they have a 1-to-1 pixel.
Mm-hmm.
Because the car is there, they want to see all the detail of the car. And if you show like a scaled image, they say, oh, it's blurred. What about
right.
the screw on the wheel? The Porsche
they
logo needs to
everything.
Be sharp and nice. And they were spending fortunes on forms
mm-hmm.
whenever they had to produce that. And for me, since I already got some skills from animation and from shading and from all of mm-hmm. that, it was quite easy to grab CAD files, they were there hanging on a server
mm-hmm.
and start shading, you know. So one thing took to the other one. Suddenly you're shading cars, you're getting like big renders in a fraction of the time that they were doing with render farms.
Mm-hmm.
And they start like noticing, okay, ooh, this GPU thing, it's working actually.
Right.
I mean, people are like all the other artists, like the dinosaurs from the industry, the guys that were producing content side by side. Mm-hmm. With me, sometimes I was doing After Effects and guys mm-hmm. working with CPU, they were always running away from GPU like from the devil.
Well, let me ask you this because I'm gonna I'm gonna play devil's advocate and I know the answers, but their CAD data is very very heavy usually.
It's insanely heavy.
So that's one of the things that people are scared of is the fact that the data is very, very heavy.
As long as you can fit the mesh on the GPU, they will handle it.
Okay. So what How big are these GPUs that you're working with?
12 gigabytes, like the 1080 Ti's.
Right.
They are enough. Because, okay, I have like a 4 gigabyte mesh.
Mm-hmm.
It's already a lot of polys in that mesh. It's mm-hmm. insanely big.
Mm-hmm.
And then you drop some shaders, some scans. You don't need that much, you know? Like 12 gigabytes is already a lot.
I think that people need to know that, because I think people think that, like, oh, my scene will never fit.
Yeah,
12 gigabytes is actually a huge amount of
it's a lot
space,
and it's a lot.
It's not equivalent to CPU RAM, right? Because you can act is you're only fitting the data of the content on there.
Exactly.
You're not fitting all of Macs. You're not filling all of Windows. You're not filling all of anything else.
Right? Yeah, it's true. And actually, the way that they compile this scene and the way that the compilation mm-hmm. actually they use less
right.
VRAM. I mean, according to space, like.
Mm-hmm.
Than the RAM,
right.
because they are trying to optimize and optimize and optimize and trying to get 1-to-1 pixel
mm-hmm.
using way less RAM
right.
than using CPU, because CPU don't demand to use less RAM, because
you can just
buy a system with 128
right.
gigabytes of RAM.
Doesn't
and
matter.
GPUs are getting closer with NVLink, so there won't be one day that VRAM won't definitely be an excuse.
Yeah.
I think it's not anymore.
You don't think so, yeah.
I think like for these guys that they're using like lots of trees, you know, like TIFF, shaders that the scene gets like 120, like 100 gigabytes.
Right.
But yeah, these guys, they started working on the scene with CPU from the bottom, right?
Right.
The trick is like just jump into GPU, see how it works.
Right.
If you think that you can adapt, or if your scene fit
mm-hmm.
on the GPU, you're just going to sell your render farms and buy yeah. GPUs. And if you don't get happy
or
with
get
the
a
GPUs,
GPU farm.
If you don't get happy with the GPUs, you can drop my email here. You can send me the GPUs. I will handle them.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing that's really cool about it is that, you know, if you have a big, you know, big workstation, you can just add another GPU and the speed goes way up.
Yeah, that's how I started. You know, when I moved out to Germany, the company they dropped me on a standard workstation.
Mm-hmm.
So with my first paycheck, I bought my first computer with a motherboard with 4 PCI Express
mm-hmm.
expansion slots.
Yeah.
And I bought 1780 Ti because, I mean, it's the first paycheck. You don't want to go wild and beg for money to somebody else. And mm-hmm. on the second month, I bought 3 extra 780 Ti's.
Mm-hmm.
So I was running with 4 GPUs in less than 2 months.
Right.
They're cheap. Like the 780 Ti's on that time, they costed like 400 euros each one. So a system with 4... it would be 1600.
Right.
Right, yeah.
And it's 4 times faster than what you had at the beginning of the month.
Way more.
Yeah.
Way more. It's insanely more. I think that everybody that will try for the first time, they will be quite surprised.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing how if you have the right GPU horsepower, it's amazing how fast you can go on the footprint of one computer.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's insane. I mean, I don't even remember anymore how it is frustrating to render with a CPU, but every time that I have to actually render something on CPU,
mm-hmm.
it's just like, you know what I'm talking about. You get shocked. You think like, what?
I gotta wait.
Yeah, you cannot even browse on Facebook because it sucks all your resources from the system, and that's something else. You can actually render on GPU and compose on Nuke at the same time because they are using different resources from your workstation.
Yeah.
So you don't need to have one render farm rendering and get another workstation to compose the frame that you're rendering on the other machine.
Right.
You can use your workstation and use 2 different tools at the same time.
Yeah. 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 Have you tried using the hybrid stuff as well? Or
Yeah, I did. I mean, all my systems, they have dual Xeon, like the farms.
They need to, because they need to.
And they cut render times. They are there. You can use them for free.
Yeah.
They don't affect the overall scene.
Yeah.
If they are there, why don't you use them? And they cut like on a 10 minutes to render, they cut like 1 minute, and 1 minute is a lot on the sequence of several pictures.
So you're doing a lot of animations too, right?
Yeah, we do. It was one of the main reasons. If you work with,
because you got to do these sweeps across the car,
turntables, close-ups, and not so. I don't do car animation, thanks God, because mm-hmm. it's like a problem. You know, playing with the physics of the car, and then you get feedback saying, "Oh, the car looks too slow. The car looks too fast. The car." It's bumpy, the car, it doesn't look like a Porsche 911. And you think like, oh, God, why? You need mm-hmm. to press render. So nothing as good as drop the car on the scene and just press render.
Right. Yeah, I did a bunch of car commercials in a previous
career. You know. Yeah.
We had one of the things that allowed us to get through that, and this is the thing that why we were a successful car animation company, is that this guy named Graham Feith at the company, he wrote a car simulator.
Oh, that's a time saver.
Yeah. So you actually, all he did is you would put controls of the center of
to rig the car.
The center. It was really simple. You like put two controllers where the or four controllers where the center of the wheel rotation is,
mm-hmm.
and then one controller where the center of gravity of the car is. And then his system would rig everything, and then you'd have a steering wheel and pedals, and you would drive the car.
It makes so much difference.
And it would have the balance of the car, and it did everything. And all he would return back was like, you know, the wheels would rotate at the right speed, and then the car would bank at the right balance. And he had built everything into it. He had built like a ABS system, all-wheel drive system,
oh, Jesus.
Everything. And he also had this amazing thing where if your car would lose traction, which we would do often when we were doing sports car, well, it would drift. That's natural. It would drift, but you would put how much friction was on the car and all on the wheels, et cetera. But what it also do is it on whatever the surface it would do, it would draw a where the skid mark would be and also measure how much pressure on the wheel it had. So he knows how much of thickness of the rubber it would leave on the road.
Oh, Jesus.
So you would just get everything just from physics, which has made a huge difference, And often sometimes we even had, when we're doing car commercials, we had the agency come over. They would like, man, the car's not quite moving. It's like, here, you drive it.
That was good. I think that was precisely my next sentence.
Yeah.
You spent too much time having fun on the simulator, didn't you?
Here's the other thing, right? Is that they would actually say things, just like you said, car's not natural, looks like it's going too slow. And we would say, it's not. It's actually going really fast. A lot of that is actually due to camera angles.
It does. Or from motion blur or from the environment.
Right.
It's too far. You bring like a tree close to the car and then the car is too fast. You bring it like 5 meters away and it's too slow.
Some of those Michael Bay films out there, they're driving these cars. They look like they're speeding down the highway. They're going like 30 kilometers an hour or less, really slow. It's just the angle of the car and the motion of the camera makes it look really fast.
It looks, yeah.
And you can do that in stills. You can do that in other things as well, you know, just that notion. I learned a lot about cars. I was fascinated. So I'm really glad we were getting to talk because there is the challenge. It's not just about the GPU rendering. The challenge of rendering cars is really big, right? And especially, I know if I said headlights, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
That's
the hardest part, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, It's an art almost.
I mean,
you need to understand what's happening inside.
Yeah,
there's two situations. You can render a car that it's far away from the camera. You just drop a flare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it works. But if you need to render a close up from a light, it's a challenge. It's really challenging.
It's
you need
a to physics understand. Thing. And CAD data helps though.
It does. You need to like just explore,
mm-hmm.
and you understand. You know, they even have materials and so on, IDs, and say, okay, this is chrome, and you just apply chrome,
mm-hmm.
and it will bounce the light. You have like the place where they have the LED standing there because it's a CAD file. It's,
right.
You have everything. Mm-hmm. It's literally a porno for the guys that love cars.
Right.
They love to do rendering because you have everything there and everything. But the tessellation is
ray tracing is critical at this point. You have to ray trace it like a real ray is going through things.
Yeah, and with the IPR and with the NACS, just bring it on.
Right.
You have fun.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
well,
true.
What's your refraction depth that you must add on that? It must be pretty high.
I will say, if you want to go completely real, you drop like 15-20.
15-20. Yeah. You have
but
to.
But if you want to go a little bit more clean, I think that 10 it's enough because sometimes all this extra detail, they just bring noise.
Yeah.
To the picture without really increasing the photorealism of the overall render at the end. So 10 bounce, 10, I think it's enough.
Yeah.
Like if the refraction bounces 10 times.
Yeah. But I think there's something, what was the, I worked on Oblivion, right? And then the drone, the bad drones that would come around and they had this little headlight, right? And had a red, like was the eye of the thing. Just like a car, like the headlights are the eyes of the car.
No,
right?
I know.
You know what I'm talking about?
The drone, they were so nice to build.
So yeah, they were, and we
like Daniel Simon, right?
Yeah.
It's like an the guy.
Yeah, absolutely. But they had a real drone that they had built, right? And it didn't fly, obviously, but they would always use it as reference. And then they had the eye, the way the eye looked. They had built it like a normal lens, and so we needed to make it look accurate. And it was really hard to get that zoom right. Yeah. And so we got that. We had dismantled the whole eye, right? And we had to measure like the
thickness of the glass,
thickness of the glass,
the curvature of the glass.
Because yes. We didn't have the CAD files. It's some guy in, you know, made it.
Just it's like
made,
a camera lens, right? It's
just... And so we couldn't figure out how to do it. And so we just like, oh, we're just making an ellipse. Like, no, it's not quite an ellipse. It's just different yeah. than that.
It is.
And so, and it would massively change the look. So we ended up taking the lens and like taking a piece of wire and just that, you know, that would hold its shape. And we'd like run it across the thing and then draw it and then actually measure that and scan that and get the actual curvature of the glass. And we had to do this for all the light, the elements. And it made a huge difference. But I had the same problem, right? That you were just describing where it gets too much noise if you put the refraction depth in there. And but in the new V-Ray, they've added the max clamping max ray, secondary mm-hmm. rays or yeah. whatever. If we had that, because some of those renders were 25 hours. because he couldn't get rid of the noise. Everything was perfect, except we had like 5 red spots in there.
And they just spent hours and hours and sampling those pixels, right?
Yeah. And Eric Barba, who was my supervisor on it, he came from like the car place too, like, right? And he said, no, I want it clean. I don't care how long it takes. I was like, oh. If I only had that feature, like it was invented like 2 years later.
It's incredible, you know, like the render, the way that it works nowadays.
Yeah.
If you compare like a few years ago, like you're just explaining.
What are your render times? Just to give people an example.
Give me
a size of an image, for example, like a big image.
I will say like 8K.
8K image, okay.
10 minutes.
10 minutes?
Yes.
For a full car?
Yeah, completely noiseless.
Noiseless?
Yeah, because I'm not a really big fan of denoisers by now.
Yeah.
They clean all the detail. I mean, all the detail is washed out. I'm using V-Ray scans. Uh-huh. They are beautiful.
Oh, you are using V-Ray scans?
All the time.
Really?
They have such a great product. It saves so much time.
So, yeah, tell me about your experience with VR scans.
My first contact with V-Ray scans was...
it's actually called VR scans, not
yeah,
V-Ray scans.
VR scans, yeah.
I work in the marketing department. We were very specific about our...
thank you for correcting me. So next time I will be punched.
Go ahead.
God, I've been saying it wrong all the time.
No.
Hey, Chaos Group, please, man. Just don't punch me now in the face.
It's okay.
Oh, it's embarrassing.
Don't be embarrassed.
It's VR scans, right?
It's not VR scans. It's VR scans.
VR scans. And I always said V-Ray scans because it's V-Ray.
I know. But it's like we do VR scenes and VR VR mesh.
It's insane. Yeah. I think it's like... dyslexia.
No, it's fine. don't beat yourself up, dude.
Yeah, it's
fine.
It's everyone does it. Worse. It's making it worse.
No. Everyone.
No, the product. It's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, like I will give example. Carbon fibers. They're natural. This randomness.
Yeah, it's really hard to make those things, right?
Well, there's a lot of guys that they have maps and they simulating carbon fiber, it's a straightforward process if you know how does it work. But mm-hmm. you need to get the maps, you need to do that. And it always looks like flat,
mm-hmm.
right? Because using maps, you generate these maps in softwares, you know, you need to have dirt, randomness. And V-Ray scans, imperfections, the pattern, it's a scan. It's a real material. It's a sample from the real world.
Right.
You're not creating a pattern in a third extension app like Photoshop and then bringing back to Max and using several layers blending on top of each other.
Right.
Leather, they look insane. I just had like a big render on the LED showing to the guys and, mm-hmm. and you can see the dust on the bump mm-hmm. of the leather, you know, like the micro imperfections because I saw, I dropped like a 20K render.
Yeah.
And then I went to a zoom factor of 1:1 and mm-hmm. you see like the leather, it's just insanely big on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see the dust like on the bump of the leather, like the pattern. And there is no way you can simulate that.
Right.
You don't simulate that.
Yeah. No, I know what a good scan can do. You get detail that's hard to
match.
And
sorry to interrupt you. Yeah, another thing that I noticed, like every artist that is doing shading, they always change the shaders according to the light situation.
Right. Yeah, that's wrong.
And with scan, you just trust. You just trust on the result. You don't fine tune a frame
right.
to make it look better. That's how it is. So yeah. It's going to look more real.
That's like saying, I don't like your skin when I'm taking your photograph. No, that's my skin color. That's what I look. Oh. You can change. And you're absolutely right. Yes. When I was working, one of the things when I was doing digital human stuff, and I'm just trying to relate some of this stuff, if that's okay. When I was doing digital human stuff, and we would get these scans of digital humans from the ICT, and they were extremely high detailed scans, right? We had 16K displacement maps for the skin on the face, right? And so you would get sub pore level scans, and we would get a diffuse map, a speculap, a single scatter map, and displacement map. And I know that data was acquired and calibrated according to a neutral situation, right? We had a Macbeth chart there. We knew exactly what the color was. We knew exactly that it was the correct color. So all I have to do with the shader is reverse engineer the math of how they got the skin, reapply that as a shader, and then don't fuck with it.
Yeah, don't even touch it. That's how it is.
Don't touch it. It's just don't touch it. It's the only thing that you should touch is the lighting. And if it doesn't match, then you did something wrong.
Yeah.
In the lighting. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's always this artistic side of everybody that is rendering things,
right.
even product rendering, car rendering, you know, you want to make it as pretty as possible, but then you sacrifice.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that you can make it as pretty as possible, but don't. But if you're taking a constant, right? Mm-hmm. Because the scan is a constant, right? So is because we've acquired that, you know what it's supposed to be. If you take the constant and start making that a variable, then you're messing up what you should do. Only make variables that are actual variables, like lighting, cameras, etc. Right?
Exactly.
The rendering is actually a photographic process, right? You think of it as a camera, right? Like you like doing short films. Great. If you like doing short films, you are going to go out there with a camera and some lights and change the composition and do that. You're not going to sit there and say, I don't like the color of the leaves on that tree. The leaves on that tree are not going to be changed exactly. If you're going out there. So leave that as what it is.
And yeah, that's what you get.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they do a great job.
Yeah. And if you want to change the color of the leaves on the tree or whatever, you do it in Nuke or, you know, in the grading and the color of the overall picture.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's awesome that you're using VR scans. And I think that's a great philosophy. Just it's correct. So why should I mess with it? Do you feel that you can change the VR scans data? Because that was something that people say is like, okay, that's carbon fiber, but that's not the kind of carbon fiber that I have.
But that's precisely what they don't want you to do.
Right.
They have a product, and this product is supposed to deliver for realism.
So do you get stuff from Porsche? Do you send it over and get it scanned at Chaos Group and get it back?
Yeah, we did with samples.
Like oh,
with
car okay.
paint. Yeah. It works.
It works great.
You get whatever you send, you get
So you're getting actual scan materials from these cars, just
mm-hmm. okay. Yeah, we get like a small piece of metal, like a sample, mm-hmm. and they just spray the car paint, and then they send you over.
Right,
you can analyze, you can try to resimulate. No, just send to the guys, to the Chaos. They will do the job for you, and you get the flakes exactly as they are.
Because that's a really important stuff in the paint, right? Is the size of the flakes, the color of the flakes. Yeah,
and all this complexity. Forget right. about it. Just drag and drop. You know, if you have lots of cars, you have lots of content to produce.
Uh-huh.
Scans, it's so comfortable.
Right.
It's just you drag and drop, and you know it's going to look good at the end.
Okay, so then what do you feel like you contribute back to the image? Obviously, you're getting the scan data, you're getting the CAD data. And now, as an artist, what is your job?
To build entire architecture on the car.
How do you achieve that?
Well, we get like a kind of a briefing saying that the car needs to be on a rural environment, on a uh-huh. high tech environment, like this kind of
right.
bullet points that you just follow and you build your own architecture.
So you build the environment around the car.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. And then the lighting. How do you achieve the lighting? What do you What have you learned about lighting cards? Because I know that's a challenge.
Oh, well, I think that I have an interesting technique to light the cards.
Oh, yeah?
I use quite often like GRI environments mm-hmm. because they bring the realism that we are trying to achieve.
Yeah.
But I don't really light it up, the car, with that.
Right.
So I create a luma mask
okay.
over the car to get the contrast or the shape that I want to for the car.
Mm-hmm.
And then I use this as a mask for the HDRI map. So you're actually blocking light according to the parts of the car that you don't want to get reflections.
Okay.
And then I just pop it up a little bit, the light, and you get the perfect light situation with photorealism
right.
over the car. And you can do that by just opening like a GR Light Studio and just create the white mask to get the shape of the car that you want to get.
Right. You're moving, you're using HDR Studio, but you're yes. moving lights within there.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I get a dome light, you know,
right.
just get the contrast that I want to get for the car. I just export that as a white map. I'm just creating the mask for the car inside
right.
of HDR Light Studio. And then I just compose it in Max and I get like HDRI on top,
mm-hmm.
the mask at the bottom, and I got my car eliminated.
Right.
That's one thing for the car. For the scene,
yeah,
I just create one spotlight above the car,
right.
according to this light situation, trying mm-hmm. to match a little bit so the car fit a little bit on the environment. So I only use two lights
okay.
most part of the time. I try to create not some like light situation not so complex.
Right. But a lot of people don't know this. Car lighting is... The way that you traditionally see car lighting, if you're going to photograph it, is you usually use a huge white silk, right? To light it, right?
Yeah.
That's usually a Fisher light of some kind. And the most important part of a car in terms of its lighting is we used to call it, I think some people still call it, called the bone of the car.
Yeah, the shape.
If you look at any car, there's usually a shape where the car reflects from up and reflects down.
Yeah.
And that shape goes along the edge of the car. And that is where you see the difference between a sky and below
exactly.
the sky. And seeing that reflection of the sky is actually kind of like a critical part of that process, right?
And actually, it's funny that you just mentioned that, because there's some mm-hmm. there's some cars that are actually easier to light it up. Like the edgy cars, normally they always look good because
the edge is creased
exactly.
into yeah.
you get the shape of the car. But if it's like a
tell you exactly a car. Go ahead, give me your example.
Yeah, and like okay, Porsches are terrible
yes.
cars to get the light,
because it's very
just a giant
soft.
Sphere
yeah.
that you need to make the car pop it up out of this
sphere. Try a Volkswagen Beetle, like the new ones. The door is like a flat surface. There's no
yeah,
crease
you
on
get,
it at
you
all.
Get everything, you know,
yeah.
like you that's quite complex. You know, when I see people doing car rendering, you see like amazing light setups, like with
right.
BMW,
right.
With Lamborghini.
Mm-hmm.
And I always imagine like, oh yeah, this guy probably has one spotlight on their scene.
Right.
The car look awesome.
Right.
Get all the shape of the car.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly right? what you're talking about.
It's
yeah.
like you need to light up a car for the first time to understand right. that some cars are easier than others.
Right. And the thing that's interesting, if you think, like, who was it? I was listening to a car show. There's a great, I don't know if you guys get it in Europe, but it was in the United States. It was a show called Car Talk. And I was at a radio show, and it was really funny. It was these two guys from Boston, and people would call in about their stupid car problems, anywhere from a really complex thing to my son came in the car and now
back
seat is wet and I don't know how to deal with it, or like just random things like that. Anyway, one time they were on the show, they were talking about how new cars now, that bone of the car, that reflection point, and they make a really strong crease now to really, so there's like, there's no way it's going to look good in no matter whatever lighting you see, the highway, the cart parking lot, whatever, right? But it always goes up, right?
Yes.
That edge is always going up, which means the trunk is always a really tall trunk and the back window is really thin.
And the car looks super aggressive.
It looks super aggressive. It looks like it's going 100 miles an hour when it's on the parking lot, right?
Exactly.
But Porsche doesn't do that as much. They have a shape, especially the like the 911s and stuff. There is a shape to the car that is traditional, and that, and you have to follow that, right?
I do, but everybody has their own tricks. I'm gonna tell you what
really?
I do with the car. You know, I tilt the car on the front suspension. Like I make sure that the car gets a different height.
Different height.
Yeah. So I grabbed the entire car besides the tires, and I just rotate to the front. So the
like
nose.
How many
gets,
degrees? Yeah, like maybe like a 1 or 2 degrees.
One and a half.
So
max,
so you barely notice it.
You don't notice, but at the end, the car looks super aggressive,
right?
Because the rear of the car, it's
nice
taller.
Nice trick.
But the front is like it's pointing to the floor, and it completely changed the overall look of the car.
Nice trick.
Don't complain because the car looks good.
Yeah.
At the end,
Yeah. The other thing is the wheels of the car. You have to orient them in a specific way.
It was my first mistake.
Really?
No, oh, it was my first mistake.
Yeah. How many? So there's the spokes, right? You have to get
exactly. If you think like the way that suspension works, like I always like to tell that the way that you get the CAD file from them, it's like if the car would be hanging on a garage, you know, like with a guy at the bottom trying to fix it.
Right.
Where the suspension just relax.
Right.
You see
yeah.
like the overall height of the car.
Yeah.
You need to drop the car. You need to let the physics work over the car.
Right.
And this creates a little bit of tilt over the axis.
Yeah.
So the wheels are actually pointed to the outside
of
the car.
Yeah, they're cantered out a little bit. Yeah.
Help me with describing, describe this to the users. So, and I had like my first render. I remember perfectly. I had a turntable with the 911 C2, like the 991 that came out like 3 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I was super like, oh yeah, my first turntable, my first car. Like, oh yeah, I'm going to do a great job. First feedback. The car looks super tall.
Right.
I forgot about the physics. I mean, you get the data, you're just a rookie. How can I handle this? Nobody explain me that. So you need to drop the suspension. I mean, you don't really
lower the body.
You just do it manually.
And
then the tires, you rotate it a little bit, the tires to the sides, like you tilt a little bit, and it completely changes the shape of the car.
Yeah.
The car looks more aggressive because it's closer to the floor.
Yeah. And the other trick is I learned is from my buddy Daniel Buck, and he used to do a lot of great car stuff with me. And he actually was really into cars, like in terms of just photographing cars too. Like he actually had skills of physically, you know, photographing cars. And he had a Mustang that he would take to all these cool places, and he'd photograph it in these cool ways. But the first thing he did when he was going to photograph his Mustang in the wild, right, is he would go in. You would put the car there. He would turn the wheels slightly, like so that you'd have a little bit of tire coming out, right? And then he would take a jack up the car, rotate each wheel so that because it was 5 spokes on the Mustang, right? So you wanted 1 spoke. If there was a logo on the wheel, you'd have to make the logo was straight.
You want to make sure.
But if there's no logo, if there's a 5 spokes, you want to make sure the 1 spoke is up, and then there was 2 spokes that were split at the bottom, so it looked weightier. So
it looks heavier. Yeah.
If it's just 1 spoke, the car looks
lighter. Looks like sometimes I forget about when you have the horse in the front and the back is with the...
Oh, the carriage.
The carriage. Yeah. Sorry. Thanks. It looks like a carriage. You know, the wheel looks thinner,
lighter.
You're going to break once you go into a sidewalk.
Yeah.
No, they're actually strong.
Yeah.
Just by rotating, I would say like 20 degrees or something. If you...
Yep.
Yeah. It's just the small details that at the end the product looks better.
Yeah.
That they don't really make that much difference over the statics of the car.
Yeah,
do they? Of course they do.
Of course they do. Yeah. No, it's a big difference, and it makes a huge thing. I mean, I learned a lot from that thing because when I started working at Sway, I knew nothing about car rendering. I learned so much from like Daniel. It was like going out. We went to there was this place, this desert area. It was a dry lake bed. So it was, a big place, flat dirt, and you were allowed to take your car out there, and you could drive as fast as you wanted without anything. It was like driving on a boat on a lake, except your car on flat area. We'd go 250 kilometers an hour on his Mustang. He had a huge motor in there, and we'd have all this, you know, dust on the car, which made it look super aggressive. And then we'd go like find a perfect time of sunset and like photograph. And then he's like, okay, and he's like this, and we're looking at that time, you know, magic hour right now. Boom.
Yeah,
okay,
to get the contrast,
take that
car
picture,
right?
Get the contrast right in there, get the sunlight right in that area.
Beautiful specular. Because we are talking about render.
Yeah, that is exactly right. Right, and you have to get the Fresnel on the angle there. It's perfect,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Because that's the other thing that people make a big mistake when they're making a car shader. it looks CG. They make the Fresnel way too high on the clear coat.
Yeah.
And it looks like, you don't need to do it anymore because you have the scans, right? But like when they make a Fresnel of like 1.6 and it looks like a Christmas ball.
It looks terrible. It looks like chrome
almost. Your Fresnel is like 1.1, 1.0, maybe less, when maybe 1.1 or 0.6 or something like that.
And then perfect. They get surprised when they drop a sun on the scene and the car explodes. Like the car, it's completely burned.
Yeah. I learned so much from that thing.
It's true. I mean, you if you jump as a rookie straight to the automotive industry, you're going to have some bad moments.
You should write it. You should write a book about it.
I have a masterclass right now.
You did a masterclass on that?
No, I'm going to do it now. I had a keynote before.
Uh-huh.
And I have a masterclass in 20 minutes. Okay. I have 20 minutes.
Oh, we'll cut this
A
one short.
To Z. Right. From A to Z. I'm going to talk precisely about everything that we just spoke until
good,
now.
Good. I'm glad people can.
Like the physics of the car. Like what can go wrong? And I tell, okay, if you follow this A to Z, nothing can go wrong.
Right.
The main mistakes.
Yeah.
And it happens to everybody.
Right.
Everybody. Like if I will be a rookie and I will talk to you and you will give me these advices, I wouldn't have done them since the beginning.
Right. No, it's true. It's absolutely true. And the thing is, those are the things that are more important than trying to make your own shaders and all the other things, right?
Oh, no, I don't shade anymore.
You don't shade anymore. That's what I'm getting at. Like, when people are worried, it's like, well, you got the scan, you got the CAD, you're nothing for you to do. It's like, trust me.
There's plenty of stuff to do.
Yeah. And it's much bigger picture than you think.
And sometimes, like everything is getting so optimized nowadays with the entire process that... one day we will lose our jobs.
You think
no,
so?
I'm just kidding.
No, I'm just kidding.
But there's a lot of people that they're. I'm not talking about complex scenes, but you're getting all these materials. You're getting like light rigs. You're getting everything is getting so much more easy right now that you can actually focus on creating something bigger. You're obviously not going to lose your job,
right?
But you're going to make something even better.
Yeah.
Like instead of focusing so much time in shading a tire, why don't you work a little bit on architecture so you make it look better?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we will never lose our jobs, but everything is getting more easy on these small...
Yeah, I think absolutely car stuff it's interesting because I did digital human work and I've done car work as well. I believe there's actually an uncanny valley to car stuff because just like digital humans, one of the reasons we fall in uncanny valley is if something doesn't look quite right, we're like, that doesn't look right. I don't know what's wrong, but it doesn't look right. Right. And like you said, the guy's like, the car looks really tall. Like they knew something was wrong, right? They didn't know that you didn't move the tires up.
No, now, they didn't. Yeah. They just think it's like, the camera.
They thought the camera was wrong. Like, you know what? That was actually what's wrong. And it's like, how does it look tall? It's CAD data, right? That's the thing that there's people are so familiar with how something looks as a car because we see them every day when we go out there, or we see beautiful renders like yours in advertising and brochures, et cetera. And it's like, that looks awesome. If you had done it when the wheel's the other way, they're like, that car does not look good. But no one would know why. They just know something's wrong.
You wouldn't do it on the beginning because you would think that you're messing around with the physics of the car.
Right, yeah.
Well, you got the data and you trust the data. I'm not going to change nothing.
Right.
Are you crazy, man? The guys that just provide the model don't touch nothing.
Right, and even just the thing, even seeing like just squishing the tire just a little bit so you get a little more highlight
on
that.
You don't do that.
Yeah.
You're afraid of messing around with the data that was provided by them. Don't touch the data. No, you have to touch the data.
The data doesn't have physics.
Exactly.
Yeah, so you have to give it the physics that it needs.
I had bad moments, like I told before.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, as a rookie, sometimes it's embarrassing, you know, like, oh, GPU, woo! And then the car looks like shit.
Right.
Oh, what's wrong?
Right, yeah.
Oh, change the camera, you know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, this is great. I'm really glad you're doing the masterclass. I know I want to make sure you have time, so we'll cut it off in a bit. But tell me about how have you been? How's Total Chaos been for you? Has it been good?
It's insane. I mean, I was quite surprised when I arrived. First of all, I mean, everybody. I mean, you're a Chaos guy.
Yeah.
I like to consider myself as a part of Chaos family.
Yeah.
And everybody is amazing. So for me, it was such an honor to come to Bulgaria and get in touch, like see people like Vlado for the first time personally.
Oh, you haven't seen him for
no, before. never had a chance. I mean, just moved out like 4 years ago to Germany, and I had like a few situations that I could actually meet some people from Chaos, but never Vlado. And when I saw Vlado walking over the room, for me it was like, Vlado!
Right,
like, it's funny because like When I started doing 3D many, many years ago, I already knew V-Ray as a render engine, mm-hmm. you know, like, and I was going to forums and Vlado was, it's the god of the industry.
Right.
So having the chance to come here was such a pleasure, was such an honor. Good. I stepped into the stage and I felt like, oh, this is awesome. Such an honor. And I was too nervous.
Yeah.
But like the entire organization, they are super efficient for the first time.
Good.
And I'm pretty sure if they make a second edition, something that will happen.
It's pretty good for our first. I gotta say, it's pretty good for our first year.
Yeah, and whatever went wrong, I didn't notice nothing.
I haven't noticed anything personally.
Nothing.
Granted, I've been stuck in this room podcasting, but I've had some really good feedback from people, and everyone seems to be having a good time. So,
And like today, it's literally like the last day, right?
Yeah.
So I think the evening will be quite nice. Yeah. Also. People will go wild. Like all these nerds drunk on the same spot. Nothing can go wrong.
All right. Let's cut it up because I want to make sure we have time to do the Polaroid.
Yeah.
And then we can get on. And do you listen to the podcast?
I do.
Good.
I do. Sometimes I'm working and like I just lose a little bit of concentration when you start laughing. I wanted really make sure that you were going to laugh a little bit more at the end, you know. So we should laugh, you know. Let's laugh a little bit now.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks, Andre.
No, but it's nice. I mean, people have fun, you know. And it's a quite easygoing situation.
Good.
I mean, I also had the chance to meet you for the first time here.
Yeah, it's true.
And
it was
quite relaxing to just stand here and talk to you.
Good, and hear my diving board laugh, right?
It's just you focus working, right? It's like you follow the sentence and then you're working, you have your headphones, and then people start laughing. You laugh also.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Andre. I really appreciate it. Let's go out and do this Polaroid,
Chris,
all right?
Thank you for the chance to be here. It was also an honor, man.
Thank you.